This is December 4th, 1986. I'm Laura Smale of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Oral History Project. This is part of a series on merger. We have interviewed Don Smith twice on his vice presidency of the merge system, and because of his own great interest in it and your plan to write a book about merger, you thought it would be interesting to have a joint interview with Ed Young this morning, who was chancellor under the merge system and then president of it, so that the two of you could discuss particularly how the merger affected the UW-Madison, what you thought you were doing about it and what you thought was happening. But we would like to begin with the, we have some questions here. What you thought yourself, Ed, were the causes of the merger, the reasons why it came about?
I think there's an underlying notion amongst state officials, whether Republican or Democrat, that reorganization is a solution to problems and concentration of authority and centralization. The idea wasn't a new one. I'd been through the battle when Governor Kohler tried to merge us years before and worked closely with former Governor Winterbaum then and others to help defeat that. So I knew something about that. This particular, I think the Lucy was looking for some new things to do and maybe to prove that that Kohler couldn't do it, he could. I'm not sure about that. And then he had Adamany as his advisor and assistant. Adamany was quite interested because he'd been a faculty member at Whitewater and was very close. But part of it, the idea was in the air in the country. These governors talked to each other and other places were merging and doing things. And it was something to do which looked like something at no cost, and you could claim you would save some money by doing it, although Lucy was a pretty smart man. I doubt if people really believed that.
I think, I of course was not here when any of this was going on, but the interpretations I received after I arrived was that David Adamany was probably the sort of intellectual godfather of merger, although without any particularly clear ideas about what a merge system would look like. And Ed's quite right. There were a lot of mergers taking place. A lot of state coordinating commissions were being established. Reorganization was very much in the air, and it was alleged to create efficiencies and save money, which I think is a dubious proposition, but nevertheless, that was the charm of it. And
there were a couple of other things that were local. At least it is alleged by others. One was that the coordinating committee was failing. The legislature didn't think it was strong enough. They thought it was dominated by Fred Harrington and Arthur de Bartleben and Gillette on part of the university, and the states were getting a bad, state university getting a bad shape. And second, that Fred broke a tacit or real agreement with the state universities about who would do what, and started an expansion program in Green Bay, Parkside, which seemed to be a real threat to them. And so the political support this time was there where it hadn't been from their side before. This was a chance to really, these are some of the things I've talked about.
You once said to me, Ed, I don't know whether you recall it, but you said that Madison was a little bit pregnant before the birth of merger, that it had already gotten itself converted into a system.
Yes.
in a formal structural way, and Fred Harrington had moved into Van Hise as presiding officer over Madison, Milwaukee, and then as they came along Green Bay and Parkside, and each of those was to have a chancellor or vice president or one or the other who would be report to Fred. So it was a very strong merger dominated out of Madison and by Madison, or by Fred Harrington, but Harrington was really in charge.
Mm-hmm. Some of the chancellors, the then presidents of the state universities, were very unhappy that the heads of the Parkside and Green Bay got paid more than they did.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots, there were a great many things, but there were lots of different forces, and Lucy brought them together very suddenly.
Mm-hmm. It always seemed to me that, Fred Harrington once said to me that he thought, in retrospect now, after a long time, one of his reorganizations, the creation of UW Extension as a separate agency, separate entity with the chancellor reporting to him rather than through UW-Madison, was probably in retrospect a mistake. I agreed with him on that particular point, and that precipitated a lot of anxiety in Madison. It also seemed to me that he had moved to not only get very good development budgets for Parkside and Green Bay based on elaborately wrong enrollment growth projections, but he also transferred money, that he used resources which had were part of Madison's budget to see to it that they were very well treated in their development year. Because when I arrived, their anxiety about merger was elaborate, and it never really went away. They had they felt that they were not ever designed to be part and parcel of the old WSU system, and of course the merger put them in that particular basket, and it was a very painful thing for them.
Mm-hmm. The earlier on, Fred had drawn a line from Green Bay to down through Madison, and said that the political strength and population was east of that line, and with Green Bay and Parkside and Milwaukee, which we got as a byproduct of the Kohler attempt at merger, and Madison, we'd have the political strength to go our own way. Well, maybe the state university people saw that too, and they pushed the other way, but it didn't work. But Fred's calculation on both extension and the political strength didn't work, but of course there were some other things he got caught up in. He got blamed for a lot of for the disruptions, which he had nothing to do with, and so on.
Well, he lived in a decade when expansion and growth and everything coming up roses was in the air, and he was a very aggressive president who moved at least from where I sat in Minnesota. I was amazed or somewhat dazzled by the speed with which he moved on things.
He was a mover and a shaker, and of course he made some mistakes, but I think we would not be the class university we are if he hadn't taken some of those chances and done some of those things. Particularly I remember discussions about federal funding. The crisis was brought about by the zoology department. They met and voted that they would never allow a tenured faculty in their department to be supported by outside funds. I was dean, and I thought to myself, you guys are going to live off everybody else, are you?
Yeah.
And but Fred, we made the decision to gamble that to a certain percentage of our budget could be solved. And if we hadn't, we wouldn't have expanded. We wouldn't have gotten the other money that we've got. People take credit now for getting this $200 million a year, but it goes back to that decision in the 60s that Fred, two or three of us, made.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the boss, so he should get the blame too.
I'd just like to ask you on the Fred's. You're saying he was responsible for getting Green Bay and Parkside. Didn't the legislature put very heavy pressure? Could it be said that Molinaro and Nelson wanted them, and he went along?
I don't know. I've heard that, but I see. I was away at that stage. I left in 65 and came back in 68, so there was a period when I wasn't around here. Molinaro was very eager to get one in the Southwest, but I'm not sure that Molinaro wasn't playing into Fred's hands rather than the other way around. But that's something mm-hmm. you get okay. the facts, you gotta go somewhere else.
Yeah, Fred told me once, he'd be the best authority on that, and I don't know whether he recalls this, but he told me at one time when we were talking after I had come here, that he did want Parkside. He felt it was that the Racine Kenosha area wanted other those two communities, and then they, of course they wound up with a place in between, was such a populous area of the state that it was a reasonable place to build a new university at that time when people were expanding. He said he was not eager for Green Bay, but that politically it became necessary to create Green Bay in order to get the votes to get Parkside and the rest of what he was up to at that time in the Eastern Corridor. So he then moved very aggressively on Green Bay as well.
By the way, before I left in 65, we were playing around with the idea of having a satellite campus out on the west side about three miles, and I think I was chairman of the committee that we looked at that, and then we would hold this campus down to a certain size. Mm. But that was abandoned in favor of going out into the state more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What about the point of money being taken from Madison for the other campuses?
Well, the thing, see, it was some of it in the base budget got shifted, I don't know, but the place where the faculty recognized it was that Wharf money was began transferred to Milwaukee. By time of merger, that was $700,000 a year, which was quite a big piece of the budget. Knapp money was going to Milwaukee. They still get a little under kind of a treaty we had. Now some of the Wharf board claimed they didn't know that was going on. I don't believe that, really. I don't know how they could not have known. But they were quite unhappy about it. And after merger, one of the first things I went to work on was getting that money back, because I knew I had to move fast, and we got it back.
How'd you do it?
Well, just by getting the Wharf to pass a resolution to the effect that the money was meant for Madison, belonged to Madison, and if some innocuous thing on the end, I think, was that if those professors over there invented anything they wanted Wharf to manage it for them, they would.
I think, Ed, in all justice, I don't think you really want to give the credit, system credit, the merger credit for doing accomplishing a great deal in higher education, but it did reconcentrate Madison resources at Madison, yes, and that happened due to your initiative. It had all taken place by the time I arrived. It was only subsequently that I found out that this had been something that happened so quickly that there was no way in which the regents or the system could have intercepted the occurrence. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I moved rather quickly. I don't usually move very fast, but on that one I did. There's a lot at stake.
I think there was a lot at stake. Yeah,
very,
that would have been a
stake,
very.
Mm-hmm. See, well, I'll tell you, the first meeting the chancellors after merger, two or three of them said to me, "When do we start getting our money?" And I said, "What money?" They said, "The Wharf money, our share of the Wharf money. That's what merger is about." In the system, there were mixed feelings about this. One of the things that was that Mr. Weaver was really very strongly for Madison. He wasn't going to do a lot, but he wasn't going to do anything ever to hurt Madison intentionally. He really wanted to be president at Madison. He if interests were not out in the state. They didn't have a football team, they didn't have Buddy Badger, they didn't have a lot of things. But his father was a professor here, and he grew up here, and he thought he was coming home, you see.
Even though he knew that when he took the job, it was Green Bay and
that Green Bay parks and that part of it. But he would be still, he didn't bother to check on much about before he came.
Hmm.
Most presidents never do, you know. He wasn't unlike other people. I got to the University of Maine, they told me everything about it except that they were at a commission to study merger, which they hadn't told me about.
They told me everything about the system, including the budget proposal. The only thing they neglected to tell me before I agreed to come here was that the governor's budget had already cut the heart out of the system proposal, and that we were going to take off in the first merged budget with an enormous financial problem. And that came as something of a shock to me after I arrived, but it was fun. I do think you're right. John didn't want merger. He spoke aggressively and publicly against it. I attended a reception up at Minnesota by his old department, the geography department at Minnesota, where he had taught and where I first got to know him, although I knew his father quite well as the chairman of the department where I took my degree. And at that time, the proposals were floating, and John was absolutely apoplectic about the indignity of scarcely getting his bags unpacked when he had come home to Madison and finding out that he had this strange new creature potential, although he thought at the time it was not going to pass, that it would be defeated and would not come to pass. And then he was, at least he told me later that he was quite uncertain in his own mind when it did pass whether or not he would accept the job. Then it was an unknown quantity. What is he going to do? If he doesn't accept the job, the board that appointed him was now still pretty much in control of the merged board. Is he suddenly going to be reporting to someone else as president of the system? And this was, something that he then resolved to go ahead. But it was very clear that while he tried very, very hard to be fair and equitable with his entire range of responsibilities, that he would not have intentionally allowed anything to happen which would be damaging to Madison, and to the best of his ability would have tried to see to it that Madison's distinction was protected. So he was, from my point of view, he was a very easy man to work with and a very pleasant man to work with in that respect.
Mm-hmm. I've said, not publicly but to a lot of different people, we really lucked out that John was the first president of the system rather than Fred Harrington, because Fred was a consolidator and pulling all together, centralizer, and he would want to run everything from up there, whereas John didn't care about that. He didn't want to do that. And I was able to work very hard at keeping as much autonomy for Madison. And on individual things, we differed, but we both had the same interest, basically, Madison. Parts he was interested in, parts I was interested in, were different, but nevertheless, his loyalty to his caring about the university was very real.
He of course, always felt that what he wanted to do was never understood at Madison. He sort of, from the very first, felt halfway betrayed by Madison, and he sort of carried his, John was a man who carried his heart on his sleeve, and it was, that was a sort of difficult dimension and also in some ways a sort of pleasant dimension of his personality. But he wanted to be recognized as the head of the entire system, as the chief academic officer, which was written into it. And it was difficult for him sometimes to believe that this kind of recognition was forthcoming, that it was not...
He once said, well, why doesn't the faculty like me the way they like you? I said, John, they don't know you. They don't dislike you. They just don't know you. You know. And that, I mean, I'm using his words. They perhaps, some of them didn't like me, but by and large, I got along with them. But he really wanted the job I had, you see, with the title of president. That's what he would have liked. Mm. And he was, one of the things, I don't know if you picked it up, but just before his appointment, the Lucy begged the regents to put it off. Just before the election, and the regents were looking for a Republican, and they had one, and they were going to go ahead with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think John always felt that his relations with Lucy were totally frozen. He was cordial to Lucy, and he had him out to his house. The only person he really liked was Mrs. Lucy, because she was quite acerbic about her husband, so he enjoyed talking with her at dinner. she spared him the necessity of denouncing Pat. Yeah.
Well, I always liked her because
she's a very outspoken
she'd
woman.
She'd say what you thought, and she'd write.
Yeah.
as Lucy himself is bright.
Oh, yes. It occurred to me, you know, as I've watched political people working. Lucy, as I've talked to him on a few social occasions since, will imply that he didn't know whether a merger was really going to pass, and it was something that he entered into because it seemed a good idea, but that it wouldn't have been a terribly significant thing to him if it had not passed.
You've heard him say that?
Yeah, that it wasn't a major item. I don't really believe that. It seemed to me that he's like nearly all politicians. This was a test of his capacity to bring off an unlikely vote. Mm-hmm. And he did it. He was a very skillful
I was in the Joint Finance Committee room when the critical vote was taken. George Molinaro was against it, and they argued very strongly. We lobbied him. And somehow he got called out just at the critical moment. That turned the vote.
Yeah, yeah.
That somehow would be interesting to explore.
Well, he couldn't bring himself to vote for merger, but and if he'd been there, he could have stopped it, and that would have put him at odds with the governor and everybody, I guess. And somebody called him out, and he went.
Lucy was a very able and very strong governor, and intended to be a very strong and a very active governor. Now, from my point of view, in the 70s, that was not a very desirable situation. I would have much preferred working with an amiable and rather slow-moving governor. The fact that he was such a capable politician, and yet I think profoundly mistaken in his relationships with higher education through that decade.
Mm-hmm. You know, before you, it sounds mm-hmm. as if you're getting into the post-merger period.
Yeah.
I'd like to, we slid over this Weaver's relations with the Madison campus. And I've never understood how the president of the system did relate to the chancellor and how, in what way he was the president.
Well,
of the Madison campus.
He wasn't president.
He wasn't. But
he
did he have any?
He appointed to be president, but then when with the merger, that made him president of the system, you see.
But did Harrington exercise much authority over you?
Well, see, there was no legal document. He was, Harrington was the president of the University of Wisconsin. It wasn't called a system. It was one university, and for administrative reasons, Chancellor, He didn't. I'll tell you why. Maybe I shouldn't. Damn machine. when I came back not to be chancellor. I came back to be vice president. Fred needed help, and he called me and said, "You were going through this merger thing. We got, you know, we got problems, a lot of problems here." In fact, the year before, I had been asked to be offered the chancellorship here, but I had a budget problem at Maine. I was going into the legislature, and I couldn't leave the place with going into it with a budget. So I stayed. The year was up, and Fred said, "Now, come back, and I want you to be the internal man, and I'll be the external man." Now, this I have never told.
I have not heard that.
Mm-hmm. Or this is what really happened. And my title would be vice president, and I went back. So I arrived back, I had an office, and I said, "Fred, how much of you have you told other people?" Well, he hadn't told Clodius, who was thought himself as the executive vice president, or anybody else. He said, "You're skillful, you can work your way into this." That's a great way to go about things. But decided to decide what I would do, and about that time, Bill Sewell resigned. And the question was, what was going to happen? Well, there was a committee, or there was an old committee was reconvened. I don't know exact details, but anyway, the competition for the job wasn't very great. The wisdom was that whoever went to Madison was going to be destroyed. And better stay where it's safe in Van Nuys, away from all that fuss and bother. Well, I didn't see it that way. I saw that Madison was important. That's where the action was. So I remember Jim Watt was trying to persuade me that, you know, we were very close friends, that this was a foolish thing to do, come to the Chancellor of Madison.
That was because of the student unrest?
Yeah, you know, and there was no solution for it, and whoever took the job would be the fall guy and so on. So, but I took it. But I was in a special situation. Fred needed me more than I needed Fred.
So.
And Fred backed me and left me alone. So occasionally one of his henchmen would come and suggest something, and I would either take it or leave it. But actually, I had a great deal of autonomy. I think at another time, well, backing up a bit, when the chancellorship was first created, I was offered it when I was the Dean of Letters and Science, informally by Fred. This is not an old written letter or anything. And I said, "Well, the way it's going to work out for a while is that the Dean of Letters and Science is more important than the Chancellor's going to be." Because I had a budget. I know where the things are, certain things. And so let's find somebody else, and we did. But found Robin Fleming, which the law school still thinks I connived.
So did Weaver treat you the same way then? Leave you alone?
Oh, yeah, Weaver did. He left most everybody alone. There were little things, like a letter from Mrs. Weaver telling us what we could do socially and couldn't do, which, you know, is kind of, but she's not the only president's wife who's written such letters. And we didn't take that too seriously. You know, my wife and I never expected to get ahead in the social world, and so we've been worried too much about that. John spent a lot of time with Arlie Mox, with the Alumni Association. Pom-pom girls went to the house regularly and things of that. The trappings, John loved the trappings. But when it came to the really critical issues, he never gave me any trouble. I'd go talk to John. Now, he had people working for him sometimes who were eager to get in and tell me what to do and do things. But some of them were useful things, you know. If supposing the vice president wants to help the music school, if he finds the money outside my budget, that doesn't hurt me. I might say, "Well, he's interfering, but he can have the music school as far as I'm concerned." You know, that was my attitude, as long as he pays for it. And so we had, but John, you know, I could go talk to John. Now, John, I think he could agree with me, and then there would be counter pressures brought to bear on him, and so it might be he tried to compromise. He wanted peace and quiet, sort of. He wanted things to go along. He wasn't power hungry in the sense that he wanted the outside world to regard him as the president of the University at Madison. That's what he wanted. And for instance, he got an agreement before he came that he would be at the time of merger, before I could talk to anybody, that he would be the AAU representative.
Hold on, I gotta. Yes.
Well, John belonged to a small group of system presidents, California, Texas, two or three others, and they all felt the same way about this, that they wanted to be the AAU person. And they got some resolution run through the AAU because they were members and it got worked out. And then John came back and told his regents, got them to agree to, because they didn't know what he was talking about really, and it didn't mean anything to them. But that was the kind of thing he wanted to do. He went to the Big Ten meetings, which really was none of his business. But he went there, the only thing that he was involved in there, when he had any much interest, was the athletic program. He'd get up and leave after that was over. I went too, see. Whereas in some place like Indiana, Jack Ryan wouldn't let one of his campus heads go. Mm. So again, John...
But Weaver didn't mind your going.
Well, he didn't oppose it. No, John didn't want to fight about things, you see. Now, you've got to watch what I say, Don, because I may be exaggerating sometimes. See, Lucy appointed a number of regents, and it wasn't very long before I had more friends on the regents than John did. But I never went behind his back and used him for anything. But he knew that if it came to a showdown, it might be sticky. But we didn't have any occasion to have a showdown. My arguments were not with him, they were with Don Percy. And they usually weren't tremendously big things, but the guy was, see, Don was the day-to-day president in the sense that he ran things, and he had great influence. I recall when, you may or may not know, that the faculty suggested that I be the president, and John was picked over me, and which, you know, regents had reasons they wanted to get a new appearance for the university, and they wanted a Republican, a conservative. They were under a lot of heat for the disruptions, and that was fair enough. And as it turned out, in hindsight, worked was the best solution. Not for the reasons they did it, but for other reasons. They said to John, "Now, if you ever need any advice and have any problem, ask Ed Young." Well, you know, the regents, when they appointed Connie Elvium as president, I was chairman of the committee, advisory committee, instructed him to have Fred Harrington as his vice president. So this is not an unusual kind of a... So John was told to consult me. Well, the first time he really consulted me of any consequence was Don Percy was bearing down on him to be made executive vice president because Don said we were doing it and he ought to get the title. I dealt with Don. He'd worked for me when I was dean, so I said, "Well, I'll tell you, John, I wouldn't do it." I said, "You're going to stir up a lot of feeling around the system, and it won't make a damn bit of difference because Don's going to do it no matter whether you get the title or whether you don't. He's going to behave the same way." So he agreed that I was right, and then Don got a hold of him and put the pressure to him, and it was announced he would be the executive vice president. Well, immediately, some of the chancellors out of state got on the phone, because at that time, the chancellor from Platteville, who was the from the old system of the state university system, was the president of the regents. He was in Spain vacationing. Somebody got a hold of him. He called John and said, "Look, got to rescind that, and for every position in your administration of any importance, is that somebody from the old UW system, has got to be somebody from the state university system. So Don lost his title as executive vice president. Len Haas was brought down from Eau Claire to be the county's counterpart. Len spent 2 years sitting around trying to think what he might do. Then his acting chancellor died, and he was glad to escape back. So it was Don Percy. See, but Don didn't. If John had backed Don to the hilt, there would have been more control up there, more interference, because Don is a very bright and aggressive guy. So, but because of John's affection for Madison, in a sense, I think he didn't really want to tangle with me, and I didn't want to tangle with him. See, neither of us wanted a row. It wouldn't help the system. And I think I supported the system. I mean, not the merger, but making it work. I tried just as hard as I could. But I did something else. I tried to maintain the autonomy of as much autonomy for the individual universities as possible. I kept talking about a federation of universities.
Well, that's mm-hmm. You had some questions about Don Percy and also about on the issue of autonomy. So,
yeah, I enjoyed working with Percy when I came here. Ed knows a good deal more about his background and what had gone on before. And there is one question I do have to address to you, because it had to do with rumors that I picked up after I arrived. I was really cautioned before I took the job by Bob Clodius, who was over in Indonesia at the time, and who was was well disposed toward working it out if I wanted to do it, because he was rather concerned about the system as everyone was. That I should make two conditions of taking the job of Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs. This was to be a parallel job with Don Percy's title as Senior Vice President for Budget and Planning. One was that I be paid more than Don because of my seniority and credentials. And two, that I occupy the office, the big office that he had occupied next to the president. Well, I took the advice carefully, and it was non-committal, and neither of those things meant very much to me. I really didn't come to Madison to make money, fortunately, because I would have been seriously disappointed. And I was not, actually, when I did arrive here finally, the old vice president's office that Don occupied rather depressed me. I finally wound up in it, but it was it's what I referred to as the last outburst of opulence in an administrative building in a public university in America. You know, it was a very large and very well-appointed office. And I much preferred being down on the next floor where most of my staff would be, so that we could walk back and forth and not be separated by a floor. So that didn't bother me, and I don't think it was ever particularly troublesome to me. The other thing, I was cautioned a little by Irv Shane to be careful. Don was a very quick-moving man who had been in charge of almost everything. And I said, well, I didn't have any particular worries about the ability to be cautious. And I enjoyed working with him. Don, so far as I know, never contested with me on an issue which I thought was properly the responsibility of my office, where I had a position, a policy position, or a document that I wanted to push forward. He would, we shared documents and policy papers with one another, and we made comments, but he didn't row with me as to whether or not anything that I wanted to do was not perfectly all right, including the one document I'm quite proud of, which is the one that the Regents adopted, although I think they've forgotten it, stating right flatly that the University of Wisconsin system was a federation of universities. That's the fundamental.
So that was your invention?
Yeah.
Well, it was. We both had the same view.
Yeah, we had the same view on that, yeah. And I thought it was
I've
important
never heard
to get
that
it
phrase
as a,
used.
Yes, as a matter of fact,
I've used it many times.
The Audit Bureau discovered it in its their recent audit, and it appalled them. They thought it was it was not what was intended. Well, I think it was a fair reading of the merger bill, which was a lumpish and uninterpretable document.
Yes.
And it was a very important document, and I think the Regents, when they first passed it, the board at the time paid some attention to it, and John believed in it. He was an extraordinarily quick man. The one thing that, in a way, entertained me, and in another way, sometimes made me a little bit cautious about him, was the speed with which he moved. He would be downtown, he would be back in his office, he got there early in the morning, he was enormously energetic. He produced paper voluminously. He was inventive. He had a good sense of humor. He was a pleasant man to work with. On the other hand, he was a man of almost unlimited ambitions and almost unlimited belief in his own capacity to reach judgments and to reach sound judgments. And even though I think the one thing he desired most was to be thought of as a man who had moved and worked his way into academic administration and understood universities academically, the fact of the matter was he did not grow up in a university culture and had not gone through the long period of induction into departmental business and departmental affairs. And
in spite of his long period on the Madison campus. Do you
That's
agree
right.
with that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. But see, what was he doing on the Madison campus? He was a kind of budget officer. He came here to be the budget officer of sorts for Math Research Center, which was, you know, could have been 100 miles away. Later on, it was out in Wharf. It didn't make any difference where it was. Then when he worked for me for a short time, he was a sort of assistant dean or something for... again, budget matter, but it wasn't very long. It was a short time because Clodius spotted him and saw this talent and invited him over there, and he moved fast. After I went to Maine, I asked him if he wanted a job at Maine, and he thought he did. So he came out, and we had a discussion, and he said, "Well, of course, he'd have to be the senior vice president." I said, "What'd you say? Senior vice president?" I said, "Look, these people have been here doing a good job for 20 years, and you don't know a damn thing about it. I'm not going to put you over them. You're crazy." We, you know, amicably broke off. But see, that was the measure of the man. He moved in very fast.
And he was extremely ambitious for titles. He loved to get the opportunity to teach a course. Because, you see, then this would immediately push him into a different world. But he was a very quick study.
Mm-hmm.
He was he was in many ways the most, the quickest moving man I ever worked with. And he could be a public relation, he could be in charge of public relations, in charge of the budget, in charge of developing the Regents' agenda for at least two of the committees. After I got here, I always developed it for the Education Committee. And it was sort of a dazzling display of just fleet-footedness and analytical. Very skillful analytically.
But after a while, the people saw Cordillo and began to have suspicions about the integrity of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Because he, for instance, he did a number of things. The Lemon and Broysher would be sent downtown with the university's position. He'd briefed them. He might get on the phone with one of the, or the chairman of the committee while they were down there after they've told what the position was and cut a deal that was different. See, and they so he undercut them with that kind of activity. Now, he might be right, cutting the deal, but it seems something sort of unethical and immoral to me about sending somebody down with instructions to say that this is our position and then have it destroyed. At least if you're going to change it, you ought to invite them up and let them go back and change it. But he didn't. He did that kind of thing, which John says he was very, very quick. See, when he arrived, one of the things that was going on before Fred resigned for a couple of years, he was Clotus's assistant. But he would say to Clotus, oh, I'll take care of that, I'll take care of that. And Clotus was spending a lot of time off the campus on various projects. Fred and I both told Clotus, I said, Mother, don't you understand that this guy is taking your job away from you? Well, Clotus didn't pay much attention to that, but that's what we're doing. So when Weaver became president, the regents told him to get rid of the other vice presidents, but keep Percy, because Percy was the one who was so able. Percy sensed what was happening. He's very quick, and he began to get himself positioned, so to speak, before the change came, which was a good thing to do, I guess. That's what people ought to do if they want to survive.
To what extent, Ted, when I got here, one of my staff members, who shall remain nameless, said that he told about the speed of what he referred to as the Saturday night massacre, the fact that after a merger, one morning, there were something like four vice presidents who were holdovers from Harrington's administration, who were all in the system, technically, on Monday morning they were all gone. Mm-hmm. Virtually, it happened that quickly. I don't know that it was quite that
very
quickly,
fast.
But it was very fast. And your impression was that this was an instruction of the regents, or my staff member said he thought that Percy talked John into the belief that he had to start with a clean slate.
I think one or two regents made grumbles. There was no formal action, but could be used by Percy to further. John trembled when the regents,
he took them very seriously.
Word of any individual regent, he took it as being sometimes a view of the regents, and many times was a minority view, but he got the clear distinction from the whole Harrington thing was bad. One of the people who really got caught up in this and couldn't believe it, it didn't go quite that fast, but shortly after this massacre, Clodius and Weaver, or at least maybe Clodius, told me that Bob Taylor had to go because the regents didn't want him around because he'd been associated with Harrington. I never bothered to check whether the regents wanted him around or not. The regents sometimes tell me that some ought to get rid of certain people. I never paid attention to that. If they wanted to make it an issue and have a board meeting on it, that would be all right with me. But they never did. When I became dean, the first thing that Fred and Elvin asked me if I got fired those two yet. One of them was Doremus and the other was Rudicelli. They disliked him intensely. They assumed the first thing I would do would be to fire those two no good people. I never fired them. I didn't pay attention to that kind of stuff. Let them make the issue. But Don wanted to use this, and they said we've got to do something. Would you help us find something for him? So I went to Bob and I said, Bob, your time in that system isn't very long. He didn't know how short it was. And he said, why? He said, I'm doing my job. He says, I've been loyal to three presidents. He was just absolutely, he's great integrity, Bob Taylor, about things like this. He was just as loyal to Weaver as he was to Harrington or anybody. He worked endlessly. His one fault was he was such a soft touch. If somebody had lost their job working for the Cap Times, he'd hire them and give them a job. But so he had a staff that was, but he did their work for him, so I couldn't complain. Anyway, so I persuaded him that he had, you know, there was no, he wasn't going to work there. He said he couldn't understand it because he, why were they doing this? Well, this was the kind of situation. They kept one guy on though. That was Engman Engman had to go too because he was the hatchet man. Mm-hmm. And I found a place for him in environmental studies, and then he stayed on there. Nobody suggested that Reuben Lorenz go.
No.
That never came up. Reuben, by the way, and one of the protections that Madison had when Reuben was over there, Reuben would not discriminate against the others in favor of Madison, but he made sure we never got shortchanged. He did his job as fairly and squarely as anybody possibly could. But he was there always, and you know, that was the person in the system when I was chancellor. When I really wanted to talk it over in some system problem that was serious, I'd go talk to Reuben. Not that he would do anything, but we just, he could sometimes point out to me the reasons why it had to be this way or why it did, or what I could do about it or something. But he was one of the great citizens of this university, Reuben Lorenz. So you had this kind of uneasy situation up there with Clodius, with Percy, because you couldn't tell where he was going to go. And I'd seen the way he forced other people out and undermined Clodius and so on. Clodius had it coming to him in a way because he wasn't doing his job at the time. He was away so much for personal reasons, I think. I knew Percy well enough, so I never really trusted him in a sense. I wouldn't count on him, because not that he would lie to you, but he would find a reason for doing something different, or changing the position. It was always, he was great at rationalizations. he knew 100 ways of rationalizing. And so, but it was an uneasy thing. Once or twice he threatened to go to the Regents and tell them about me. And I...
What did he tell
you? I can't even remember what it was. Some issue where I was differing with him and not doing what he wanted me to do. Something, it may have been some form of reporting or it wasn't any big issue or something, but he's a bureaucratic mind. Yeah. He liked to have everything his way. He'd cook up some scheme. He had a scheme for a while that was going to have charged tuition according to the level of the class. He'd charge a freshman less and upperclassmen more and things like that, and these schemes. So yeah. I would oppose these things.
So I was just reading the Regents report on that particular...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and things like that. And so I said, well, go ahead, try it. And of course, I played poker too. I used to play in my days. And I was in pretty good position. So I was, but I would say that basically John and Percy had the same, they wanted things to work, and we all did. The Regents, the other chancellors were very loyal to the system. There was no conniving about undercut the system administration. We tell them when we didn't agree with them, but they had the backing. One of the things that Percy did, which was very amusing, he told us chancellors that we were not to go downtown and talk to legislation without clearing it with him first, and then coming back and telling what happened. That was the silliest thing anybody did. So the result of which was he lost the support of the chancellors, because those who would have supported the administration, and most of them did, with the local political people, just stopped doing it. The ones who, one or two who had particular axes to grind, went ahead and did it anyway. So we had to rescind all that kind of foolishness. So that was the kind of thing that Don was talking about. You suddenly get this idea, somebody did something that irritated him. Now, when we had the budget downtown, the Joint Finance Committee was much interested in my being there and talking to them as they were John Weaver. Because they thought John's stuff was prepared for him by Percy and written up and he was reading it, and that they could talk to me and I could tell them what I thought.
So you did go down there?
Oh, yes. I didn't pay attention to that. Why should I? You know, Madison was more important. The legislators, if I had said to them, look, I can't come down there because Mr. Percy won't let me, they would have blown the tops. One or two of the chancellors told them that, and they were very angry.
Now, this is after the merger.
After the merger, yes, you see. Mm-hmm. Because the merger came, you know, about the same...
I think that must have happened in the first year after I arrived. There was no... There really was no question about the fact that the chancellors... the chancellors were supposed to, insofar as possible, maintain a united front in support of the budget once it had been put together, but it was considered... A strength that they get in contact with their local legislators, and if they come down and testify that there were particular items. So I think that had been I really enjoyed. See, Percy he was my major reason for major way of getting fully acquainted with what had gone on in the. Months before I arrived, when I was downtown with him jointly, we were never out of tune. He was downtown a lot of more than I was. I didn't regard myself primarily as a lobbyist, except in major committee hearings. Although I did go down, and increasingly as the decade went on, I did spend more time than I wanted to down in state government. He was very active on that front. Matters of all of the interactions were in that first year are things that I wouldn't personally have experienced. Now, I think it's true too that as I began getting a grasp on what was going on. I don't know whether you know that one of the signals that I felt I had begun to understand the budget process and the policy framework that had been set up was when we started producing some little known and not very significant documents called academic budget planning papers. These were an effort to meld academic planning and budget planning, which was a nice idea. Prior to that time, we had two series. One was the budget planning paper, and the other were the so-called academic planning papers, and they moved on wholly separate tracks, which I think was all right when you're trying to get things under some kind of policy framework. And I would draft the one, and Percy would draft the other. But then it seemed to me that we were going to have to begin to work the entire scene if there was to be any rationality between the budget and the academic planning, although I'm not sure to what extent that is really feasible. Theoretically, it's a great idea. Practically speaking, it's almost impossible to bring off. And the only place where that happens is in the president's office, I think. Or the chancellor's office.
I was kind of an irritant to the system administration.
Good.
An irritant.
I said good.
Well, yeah. I don't know if that's good or bad. I think something.
Well, now you know I was in the system administration. We had enough irritations without Ed adding his.
What did you do?
Well, I always spoke up. You see. When, you know, in meetings for our interests.
In the chancellor's meetings.
In the chancellor's meetings and in the regents' meetings.
Uh-huh.
The regents expected me to. In fact, they instructed the chancellors to speak up. Most of them never did, unless they were called on by somebody. But I did. I didn't spend a lot of time. I didn't talk so much as John Smith did. He was vice president. but anyway, in the small ways, I probably should have been more, acted more as though they were in charge, you see. One time, Arlie Mox tried to explain all this to me. He said, you've got to think of it this way. John is the admiral of the fleet, and you're the captain of the ship, and you have to do what the admiral wants. This was something, some ceremonial thing or other. Well, you know, that was the idea. Well, I didn't act like that. You know, I acted as though I was a head of a pretty good university, and I'd go along with things we had to do together, but I didn't see any reason why I should kowtow to anybody as good as they were.
So how did you feel in those chancellor's meetings? I've looked through some of your papers, and I've seen these endless reports you were required to file, and you're having to sit with a bunch of other chancellors who you really, I mean, maybe you like them personally, but you can't have had much use for their institutions.
I did have a lot of use for their institutions. I was fortunate in that I'd visited most of them before, and I had a great deal of respect for them. There were years when I was out around the state a good deal talking and visiting. I still have a lot of respect for them. I know people on, I probably knew at one time people on every campus. And I never had that feeling. I had the feeling that I had to look out for Madison, but if getting them something got us something.